Hi.
Hi.
So, what's this book about?
You didn't read this one either?
Well, I was gonna, but I accidentally read something else.
What?
Vogue.
I hated the book, all right? I have no idea what it's about, and the writer was clearly on drugs when he wrote it. I mean, it went on and on and on like it was written in a total hurry. If I handed in something like this, there's no way I'd get a good grade on it. I mean, it's boring and it's unorganized. And I only read 30 pages of it anyway.
Well, that was passionate, albeit entirely misinformed.
Who dares follow Miss Kelly's lucid analysis?
It's required reading.
With Tom and Stella.
Episode 91, Paper Towns by John Green.
The way I figure it, everyone gets a miracle. My miracle was I wound up living across the street from Margot Roth Spiegelman. She was inarguably the most gorgeous creature that God had ever created. Margot's life was a series of unbelievably epic adventures.
Are you going to spend the rest of high school pining for this girl?
As senior year drew to a close, Margot and I were practically strangers. Until this one night.
What the? Margot?
I need to borrow your car.
What?
I have 9 things I need to do tonight.
Can't you just get your boyfriend to do it?
Ex-boyfriend. My boyfriend has been cheating on me. Revenge plot begins.
Not as weird as it looks.
Stop.
I can't believe you just did that.
Take the picture, now.
Okay, now that was fun.
I can feel my heart beating in my chest.
That is the way you should feel your whole life.
It's beautiful.
It's a paper town. Paper houses and paper people. Everything's uglier up close.
Not you. You think it's gonna be different in the morning?
I really hope so.
Margot always loved mysteries. Maybe she loved them so much, she became one.
She's gone.
When was the last time you saw Margot?
You were with her her last night. It has to mean something.
There's something in Margot's window.
She left little clues, like breadcrumbs.
I found something. I think she's sending you a message. Come find me.
We're trying so hard.
You'll go to the paper towns and you'll never come back.
I think I know where she might be.
I'm going with you.
She's going, I'm definitely going.
Take a risk. Stop playing it so safe. Maybe that's what she's been trying to tell me the whole time.
What can I say? I'm on a mission.
Hey!
You love her, right?
Yeah, I do. Everyone gets a miracle. My miracle is Margot Roth Spiegelman.
Hello and welcome to Required Reading with Tom and Stella, a podcast that is brought to you by the True True Freaks Internet Radio Network. This podcast is all about books and literature, and each month we will take a thorough look at one piece of literature we have both read and determine whether or not it is required reading. As always, I'm Tom Panarese, and joining me on this long road trip all the way to a paper town somewhere north of Baltimore is my lovely co-host, Stella. How are you?
Woo! I'm so good. And I did not need to pee in a can of, or a bottle, I guess.
Like
of,
a Gator? Oh, a beer bottle.
It was, yeah, originally a beer bottle, yeah. I don't have that skill, sadly. But we made it. We made it okay.
Yeah. Yeah, so, yeah, it has been, yeah, we made it through our smut special, too.
Oh, my gosh, yes.
Yeah, and that just dropped as of our recording for this, so we haven't gotten any feedback about it. And so we'll be talking about that next time. Although I must mention, if you did listen to this and you're listening to this episode, that I accidentally misgendered the author of Genderqueer, Maya Kobabe or Kobabe, K-A-O-B-A-B-E, is her last name. And he uses what are called Spivak or Spivak pronouns, which are E-M air, and I accidentally used she, her. So I just wanted to clear that up in case anybody noticed that in the episode. I hate when people do that, and I was not doing it on purpose. Okay, that out of the way, this is going to be way less explicit than last episode.
Yes, I don't think anything explicit really happens. I'm trying to think. I mean, we've got no. Ben and his honey bunnies. kind of behind the scenes, there's an assumption of stuff going on. Yeah. But yeah, no, way more toned down.
Yeah, the explicit stuff is like prank level things. So it'll be incidental comedic nudity is in there. But no.
Incidental yeah.
comedic nudity. Yeah, but no, we're doing Paper Towns by John Green. We're both heading toward the end of the school year too, which is perfect for this particular novel because it takes place right at the end of a school year. So before we get into it, how are you doing?
Yes, I am doing well. I feel at this moment very checked out at my current job, as a sub. Mm-hmm. And I think it's just like, it's great for me that I know what I'm doing next yeah. year. Because if I was just checked out, it would probably be like, I'd be despondent because which we were going towards that place just with all the rejections and everything. So I'm very happy that I have a place to live and a job that I'm excited about. I think it's going to definitely have its challenges, but being someone who's not fresh off the block, I know what to expect. So at least I'm going in there with a clear mind. And I will say in regards to the smut that I finally caught up to all Elle Kennedy's with the exception of the Summer Girl, but all of her campus series and was like in preparation for her release and for the first time got one of her books on release day, The Dixon Rule. So I'm currently enjoying that. It's overall a fun time. This will be the last time that Tom and I record. No, I guess that's a lie, second but it's close time. To the last. Yeah. The second
the
to last time.
The penultimate time.
Yes. That Tom and I will be recording in the same state. But I think our bond, you know, has always been close and I will see him most likely in September when he goes to Baltimore Comic Con. There's no reason why I should not come out and see you and have lunch with you and, Brett. So I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah. I am looking forward to that quite a bit. Actually, we are, Brett's already making a costume and I'm got some VIP tickets this year. So I'm really looking forward to it. Cause this
fancy.
Is probably Brett's last one. At least until they are in town around the time of Baltimore Comic Con, because in the fall of 2025, they are headed to college wherever they decide to go. So yeah, we visited three colleges already. So we visited.
Okay, so decisions are still being made.
Decisions on where to apply, yes, because
on where to apply, yes, to apply. Yes.
So
okay.
we just visited three colleges, you know, and they were all three were in Virginia. It was William and Mary and UVA and JMU. So we might branch out and stuff, but we're just kind of, you know, getting a feel for the ones that are like really interested. Brett really liked William and Mary, so
okay,
yeah. And I think UVA is like second on that list, but okay. I think they want to go away. So I'm like, go ahead.
let the little bird
right,
open their wings.
Yeah, well, right now it's APs, or last AP is tomorrow, then a math final, a paper for A push, and prom is Saturday. So it's a lot. It is. I forgot how big junior year was 30 years ago.
Oh, yeah.
Ago, but yeah. So, but our particular characters are seniors toward the end of their senior year. Before I get into the history of the book as well as the author, Stella, what is your history with Paper Towns as well as with John Green, who by now is a pretty established author in YA?
So, yes. And I will say that when I was reading this, can I say that the library did me dirty?
Oh, yeah. Tell everybody about this. This is so weird. And I'll talk about my – I do want to talk about my copy when I get into the history of something because my cover is particularly interesting.
Yeah, so I put it on hold at the library that Tom and I frequent, and – I go in to pick it up and it's smaller than like normal when you're looking at the whole shelf and everything. And I pull it out and it is, and my hand is small, the size of my hand from wrist to, I guess, maybe second knuckle. Mm-hmm. And I go up to the register, the checkout desk. And I'm like, is this a joke? And you have to open it up laterally in order to read it. And she said, you know, she's trying to make a positive, like, well, maybe it'll be easier to read. It's not easier to read that way, I just want to say. She asked if I wanted to not take it, and I said, no, I'll just suffer through it. But it was the strangest thing I had ever seen. Maybe it's supposed to be like an atlas, a mini road atlas or something you would get at a gas station. I don't know. But it was, I took a picture and sent it to Tom, and Tom's response was, I don't know what I'm looking at. And I'm like, yeah, me, you and me both, brother. So that's my, that's what I had to do, which made the copy 600 pages.
Good God.
Because of how small everything was. Yeah.
It sounds like the type of books they used to make for like people like in the military in like World War II.
Oh my God. Oh yeah.
Back in there.
Because you could cut it down. Yeah. Yes, our one of our, I was going to say our favorites, but the, let's see, Wild. That would have been a great book for her. Yeah, because she could have fit that and cut it down. I did, when I was looking for the cover image for this episode, find this popped up, and it's like, I guess it's a whole brand of things of like Mini Penguin or whatever it is. So if you want to see what that looks like. But, okay, so... Yes, I was reading that at Michael's, and I think, when a customer comes up, obviously I put it away. But I was waiting on the manager for something, I think, and he asked if I was liking this. And I said, oh, I find, you know, some of the characters annoying. And he said, isn't that every John Green novel? And I thought, oh, that's a funny thought.
It's actually pretty true, too.
Yeah. So John Green, who is, besides us doing this episode, I just sent Tom, maybe last week or something, a trailer on Instagram of Turtles All the Way Down. Or whatever. Yeah. Which is now on Max. Have yet to watch that, and I haven't read it. Mm-hmm. The first, I feel like I go backwards with things. So I think that I saw The Fault in Our Stars before I read it.
Uh-huh.
And so that would be my introduction, because that was big.
Well, that novel's huge.
Yeah, that was, yeah. I can think about my class that I was teaching then and where those students are now. Probably, they're definitely out of college. And I just remember, well, I don't need to go into those details. But yeah, so I can just clearly remember, you know, when the eighth grade class was reading that and talking about it. So, of course, you know, I always try to engage in stuff that my students are engaging in. So that would have been my first one. And then this film came out, and I can't recall if this was around the time or post 13 Reasons Why, which was already like kind of blowing up. And it felt like in the same vein of like, okay, this chick has gone, you know, missing. Yeah. And, you know, these like, why is this happening? Is this going to be romanticizing something? So I very actively avoided it. And then, of course, Tom brings it up. So I have read this book one time, and then I ended up watching the film this previous weekend to see kind of how it aligned. Of course, yeah. And I think that's mainly, I think those are the only two John Green books that I have now read.
Okay. I actually never saw the movie. I guess we could.
It's free on Max.
Okay, I guess we could talk about it briefly or something. I do remember seeing the trailer for the movie. I've read more of his. The Fault in Our Stars, I think, was 2011, 2012-ish. And I read this probably about, I think it might be about 9 years ago now, 9 or 10 years ago now, because a lot of my students at the time loved his books. They especially loved The Fault in Our Stars, which really, mm-hmm. I mean, he'd done three novels before that, but that was the one that like put him, like capital J, capital G, like kind of made him who he is. And so I knew what the plot of The Fault in Our Stars was because students have been using it as an independent book read, and they basically gave me the whole plot. And I was like, well, maybe I'll look for another one of his books. And the so I looked up book summaries, or maybe the flaps or whatever, at the ones they had in the school library, and this struck me as an interesting concept. Like, I was like, oh, mm-hmm. this looks like it might be an interesting book. Like the jacket text, I was like, okay, this, you know, so that's what drew me to it. So this is the first, so the reason I picked this as the first John Green or novel we would cover on the show is because this is the first one I ever read. Then between then and now, I've read, I think, all of his novels that he wrote solo. So I read, Looking for Alaska made its way into my classroom through people like donating books and things. So, cause I've just basically amassed a small library, in my room at a bookcase in my room. So I had looking for Alaska at one point and read that, and Abundance of Catherines, I think I checked out because, or I might've actually had a copy of that as well. And then, The Fault in Our Stars, I read cause I was like, well, I might as well. And Turtles All the Way Down, I read it like last year or so. Because one of my students said they really, really liked it. And I have not seen any of the movies based on any of his stuff.
Wow.
So I just have, again, but I don't get around to movies as much as I used to be able to. So that shouldn't be surprising. But yeah, so this was my first. This is our first covering it. I will get into a little bit more on my opinion of it and my opinion of him as an author. When we get to our actual review, but I am going to get into his bio and then the history of Paper Towns itself. I cribbed the bio from his actual website. So,
hey, that always helps.
Yes.
I do want to say that this guy also does history
YouTube
videos, and I would hear him because my neighbor on the yellow wing was an eighth grade history teacher as well as teaching APUSH. And during like morning sessions and stuff, I would hear John Green talking, and like he almost sounds a bit unhinged, but I suppose it's like very engaging to go through history the way that he does it.
And he does crash course videos in literature too. And they are really great videos. I highly recommend watching them. He's my age. So, and where am I in life? So
Tom, anyway. You've got that unpublished novel hiding under your bed.
Yeah. Anyway, John Green is the number one New York Times bestselling author of Looking for Alaska and Abundance of Catherines, Paper Towns, The Fault in Our Stars, and Turtles All the Way Down. He is also the co-author with David Levithan of Will Grayson, Will Grayson. He was the 2006 recipient of the Michael L. Prince Award, a 2009 Edgar Award winner, and has twice been a finalist for the LA Times Book Prize. Green's books have been published in more than 55 languages, and over 24 million copies are in print. His most recent book, The Anthropocene Reviewed, which is a collection of essays, came out in 2021. I will pause to say I've had more than one student recommend that to me, and I do intend on checking it out because I do love a good essay of that regard. Yeah, I love essays. So in 2007, John and his brother Hank ceased textual communication, began to talk primarily through video blogs that they posted to YouTube. The videos spawned a community of people called nerd fighters who fight for intellectualism and to decrease the overall worldwide level of suck. Decreasing suck takes many forms. Nerd fighters have raised millions of dollars to fight poverty in the developing world. They also planted thousands of trees around the world in May of 2010 to celebrate Hank's 30th birthday. Although they have long since resumed textual communication, John and Hank continue to upload videos, two videos a week, to their YouTube channel, Vlogbrothers. Their videos have been viewed more than 800 million times. The brothers launched the educational YouTube channel Crash Course in late 2011 with funding from YouTube's original channel initiative. John, Hank, and a range of other hosts teach humanities and science courses to viewers, with multiple new series launching every year. World history, literature, economics, physics, biology, chemistry, and government are just some of the courses available to date. Crash Course has over 10.7 million subscribers and 1.2 billion views. John and Hank are involved with myriad other video projects, include The Art Assignment, Ars Poetica, SciShow, Hank Games, Eons, and Healthcare Triage. John's book reviews have appeared in the New York Times Book Review and Booklist, a wonderful book review journal where he worked as a publishing assistant and production editor while writing Looking for Alaska. He grew up in Orlando before attending Indian Springs School and then Kenyon College, and he currently lives in Indianapolis with his family. Since the mid-2010s, John Green has been a prominent advocate for global health causes. He is a trustee for Partners in Health, supporting their goal of reducing maternal mortality in Sierra Leone, and has worked with PIH, USAID, and the Stop TB Partnership, and the government of the Philippines, among others, in fighting tuberculosis worldwide. I believe he was also recently involved in getting Congress or the federal government to strengthen regulations to make tuberculosis treatments, the generic ones, available to people at a lower cost, if I'm remembering that correctly, because it was fairly recent. I believe Hank, his brother, is fighting cancer at the moment as well. If I do follow him here and there on social media, but my feeds get so like messy with other people's stuff that sometimes I don't see his. Anyway, let's get from Paper Towns, which is cribbed from the Omnictionary sources.
So thanks to Radar.
Yes, thanks. Thank you, Radar. So the copyright date on Paper Towns, by the way, is 2008. Now, you have the digest version, and I know the cover on the paperback is a map with a thumbtack in it. The hardcover edition of the book actually has two covers, and both of them are headshots of Margot. They're photographs of Margot, and one of them, she's smiling, and it's got this – it's this very Mona Lisa sort of smile. And the other one has it has like a yellow background, and the other one has a blue wash over it, and she looks sad. And they printed both, and apparently there were fewer sad Margot copies printed than there were smiling Margot. And according to TVTropes.org, that's caused the sad Margot edition to become slightly collectible to those who wanted both versions of the book.
It's interesting. I would also say that the sad Margot version would be more authentic to her character.
Yes, yes. The smiling one isn't even really a smile. She's kind of – it's a stare. It's kind of mischievous is the best way to put it. All right. So Paper Towns was the winner of the Edgar Award for Best Young Adult Mystery. It received mostly positive reviews. Publishers Weekly said the title, which refers to unbuilt subdivisions and copyright trap towns that appear on maps but don't exist, unintentionally underscores the novel's weakness. Both Milquetoast Q and Self-Absorbed Margot are types, not fully dimensional characters. It's also said the novel is another teen-pleasing read. So kind of a mixed review, I guess, for Publishers Weekly. Kirkus praised the novel as a winning combination, which is funny because Kirkus never reviews anything positively. School Library Journal said Q is a great social outcast, main character who sometimes thinks a little too much, but is completely relatable. Though we only really see Margot for the first third of the book, the clues really create her character and give us the feeling she's a complex person. Finding out who Margot is through the things she left behind was a really great way to develop her character. Rebecca Swain of the Orlando Sentinel said, Paper Towns has convinced me that jaded adult readers need to start reading the teen section at the bookstore. Green, who grew up in Orlando and uses the city as a backdrop for the story, taps into the cadence of teenage life with sharp and funny writing, but transcends age with deeper insights. Chelsea G.H. Philpott, who is the editorial assistant of the Horn Book Guide, says the end breaks your heart and yet it feels right. And I have to point out, so this is 2008, paperback probably a year or two later. This is like the Green's type of YA lit did exist, but it was not as popular as it is now, where you have this sort of fairly non-fantasy, maybe, you know, dip into romance here and there, or mystery about people, as opposed to, I think this was in the middle of like the Twilight era. And I think The Hunger Games is coming out at the right time. So fantasy and dystopian fiction, those things were like big, big YA things at the time. Green was one of the writers that helped put this type of YA, no pun intended, on the map in that part of the 2000s. And even though it was being published and really had been published for years, it made it – I'm not going to give him all the credit, but I want to say that books like this and especially The Fault in Our Stars made that sort of subgenre of YA like economically viable enough for what's come since. So he did sort of help open the door for a lot of other authors in that regard, because publishing companies are like, oh, we can make money off of these types of books in a big way.
Mm-hmm.
So there was certainly captured something.
It did come a year after 13 Reasons Why.
All right.
Just FYI. And I will say that one review, I mean, I'm sure we're going to talk about mm-hmm. this, but I disagree with her that we find out her character through these clues. I feel like we only find out her character through Quentin's perception mm-hmm. of her through the clues.
I don't think we really find out her true character until the end of the novel. I think that's on purpose. If I'm being honest with you.
But it's just like, did that person read the same novel that we read?
Well, yeah, and we can get into how Q is purposely set up as an unreliable narrator, right? So, but I mean, when you know that's on, like, as you go in and you kind of know that's on purpose, like he's doing that for a reason, it can like change the way you're looking at the book and Margot. So, but yeah, I wonder if the Publisher's Weekly reviewer missed that point. The book has been removed from books. It was removed on June 23rd, 2014, which would have been my birthday. June 23rd is my birthday, so I don't remember how old I was. But 37, I think. Paper Towns is removed from the summer reading list for 13-year-olds at Dr. John Long Middle School in Pasco County, Florida, after a parent complained to a board member that she disapproved of the book's sexual content. Again, there mm-hmm. isn't as much in it as some other books. The National Coalition Against Censorship responded to the removal by calling for the book to be reinstated. In a letter to the district superintendent, the organization wrote, "No sound educational rationale for removing the book has been articulated, nor is it likely that one could be." Oh. And then we have, and it's in Florida, so we all know what that's like nowadays.
Oh, sure.
Consequently, it was restored the following month. A 2015 film version was produced. Nat Wolff starred as Q or Quentin.
Mm-hmm.
Carla Delevingne played Margot. Justice Smith, Austin Abrams, and Halston Sage played Quentin. His friends Radar, Ben, and Lacey, respectively. Jess and Claire appeared in the film as Angela, who is Radar's girlfriend. If I'm being honest, I had seen the trailer and I was turned off by the casting of Carla Delevingne as Margot, because to me, Margot is not model pretty. Like, it's just, she seemed miscast. I never pictured Margot as like somebody like her.
Interesting.
I can't think of an actress that I would have put in that role from that era, but if this were the 80s or the 90s, Molly Ringwald could have pulled her off, maybe even like a Winona Ryder or somebody, but Carla Delevingne is actually just too pretty and too, like, has something that I didn't see in the character of Margot. And maybe I was prejudiced because when I first read this novel, I did read the hardcover, so I had the picture in my mind of Margot was on the cover of the book. But yeah, I just thought it was like, gosh, it's almost like they cast somebody too beautiful for the role. So Margot's not ugly or anything, but she's not like, I think they talk about how Lacey's the one who's like supposed to be like the really, really hot one. And Margot is hot, but there's a conventionality to it. And that's not Carla Delevingne. But anyway, one last note. This is about Green's use of language in the novel. He has readily discussed in the past what he believes to be flaws in his novels when he's looked at them in retrospect. And additionally, in response to a fan's tweet, and I apologize in advance for the use of this word in the sentence, Green apologized for the use of the word retarded in Paper Towns,
because
it's all over the book.
That.
And
yep.
it was pretty accurate to the way people did speak at the time. Another word that was used in the pejorative around then was gay, but I didn't see it as much in this book. But he said, "Yeah, I regret it. At the time, I thought an author's responsibility was to reflect language as I found it. Still now, 8 years later, so I don't feel like a book about humanizing the other benefited from dehumanizing language." So he did apologize for the use of the R word in the book.
Didn't he also use the other F word too?
He may have. I think it's in there as well. But I mean, that's the type of apology there that really does sound like an apology, as opposed to, you know, kind of a half-assed apology with an excuse in it.
Sure.
So,
do you think he would have changed it, though?
Probably. I mean, it, you know, had somebody pointed it out earlier in the process of writing the book, he probably would have changed it. Mm-hmm. I don't know if he's the type to just go back into his books and redo them like that. But, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if it turns out that they decide to do that or something. So,
gotcha.
So let's get into the actual plot of the novel, from Omnictionary.
Ooh.
Paper Towns mostly takes place in and around Jefferson Park, which is a fictional subdivision located in suburban Orlando, Florida. It focuses on narrator and protagonist Quentin Q. Jacobson and his neighbor Margot Roth Spiegelman, with whom Quentin has always had a romantic fascination. As pre-adolescents, Quentin and Margot together discovered the corpse of a local man who died by suicide in their neighborhood park. 9 years later, Quentin is an outcast whose best friends are Ben, a guy who talks a lot about sex and uses the word honey bunnies, and Radar, whose passion is editing the articles on Omnictionary, which is a fake name for basically Wikipedia. Margot, on the other hand, is very popular in the queen bee sort of vein. It's implied that she is kind of the queen bee of their high school. They're both now seniors at Winter Park High. A month before their graduation, Margot suddenly reappears in Quentin's life, climbing through his bedroom window as she did during their first meeting. She has devised an 11-part plan of vengeance on a group of people she feels have hurt her during her time at the high school. These people include her cheating boyfriend Jace, her peers Lacey and Becca. Margot needs an accomplice and a car to help her, and Quentin accepts. The tasks include leading dead fish for the former friends, calling Becca's parents to tell him that Jesse and Becca are having sex in Becca's room right at that moment, and then snapping an illicit picture of Jace, hence the comedic nudity. Removing the eyebrow of school bully Chuck using a depilatory. I don't think they call it Nair in the book, but it's basically Nair. Looking at the view of Orlando from a skyscraper and breaking into SeaWorld. Margot and Quentin successfully complete every task. They share a romantically ambiguous dance and return to their homes around dawn. The next day, Quentin wonders hopefully if Margot will start hanging out with him, but doesn't see her at school. He figures she's sleeping off the previous night. After 3 days of no Margot, however, she's reported missing by her parents. The detective tells him that there's really not much they can do. She's 18 already, and therefore not a minor. Her parents, who are fed up with her adventures, she's done this before. She, like, joined a circus at one point. She snuck off to Mississippi. I think she went into New York at one point or another, or something to that extent. What they decide, they're fed up. They change the locks so that she can't get back in if she comes home again. In fact, Q is freaked out by this and actually asks his parents, who are both psychologists, by the way, to take her in if she comes back, and they say they will. So Q, Ben, and Radar start to discover a series of items that Margot has left hidden for Quentin. First is a picture of Woody Guthrie that's on her bedroom window shade facing out toward his house. Margot's highlighted copy of Walt Whitman's poem Song of Myself is another one, and a written address in Quentin's bedroom door jamb is a third. So they follow these clues to find an abandoned mini mall in Christmas, Florida, that contains evidence of Margot's recent presence. Q struggles to analyze all of Margot's clues and leftover materials in the mini mall. He suspects the clues are meant to lead him to her current whereabouts, though he worries that she may have committed suicide. Based on a note that Margot has left referring to paper towns, which she also mentioned that night they went up into the skyscraper to look out over Orlando, the phrase paper towns, Quentin realizes that Margot may be hiding or buried in one of the many abandoned housing subdivisions or pseudo-divisions, or what he thinks are paper towns, around Orlando. He drives to all of the pseudo-divisions where he feels that she may be hiding, but he cannot find her. On the day of his graduation, Quentin comes across an obscure internet post with a comment left on it in which Quentin recognizes Margot's as Margot's due to its distinctive capitalization, which tells him that Margot has been hiding in a fictitious town in New York State called Algo, which was created as a copyright trap by mapmakers. And this is true. It's not just the name of a town that Green made up. And that she plans to leave Algo immediately after noon on May 29th. Quentin Radar and Ben and Lacey impulsively skip graduation to drive to Algo. I must mention that over the course of the book, Ben and Lacey start dating. She dumps her boyfriend. He asks her to the prom, and they hook up. So they all get into Quentin's new minivan. In pursuit of Margot, they're going to get to Algo before May 29th. They have a set amount of time they have to go. It's very, very calculated. They make only quick stops for provisions and gas. They find clothes for the guys because the guys had decided to go naked under their graduation robes at graduation. And then they also pee in beer bottles and chuck them out onto the interstate, which is very safe. And they also almost hit a cow.
Oh, yeah.
Moo. They finally do get to Algo. They discover Margot is living in an old, dilapidated barn. She is shocked to see them, which angers the group. They'd expected her to be grateful for their presence. Margot had left those clues only to assure Quentin that she's okay, since she did not want to be found. Angry at her lack of gratitude, Radar, Ben, and Lacey leave and spend the night at a motel. They basically say to Quentin that we are leaving with or without you the next morning. Quentin realizes the image he had of Margot was as fake as the one that she had been projecting to everyone else and becomes furious at her for wasting his time. Margot argues that Quentin saved her for egotistical reasons. He wanted to be a knight in shining armor who saved the troubled girl. Ultimately, Quentin accepts that it was unfair for him to expect Margot to live up to his perfect image of her, and he begins to logically overcome his sexual attraction toward her. After their conversation, Margot decides she's going to go to New York City. She asks Quentin to accompany her. Quentin, who is committed to going to Duke, by the way, wants to stay with her and they kiss, but he understands that his home life and responsibilities prevent him from going. Margot promises to Quentin that she will keep in contact with him. And that is the end of the novel. So, before we get into our discussion, did you like Ville de Papier?
Ville de Papier.
Ville de Papier.
I'm going to say no. I didn't hate it. And I will also say that I didn't necessarily go in with the most open of minds. Like I said, I had this kind of negative perception of what the story was going to be in connecting it with 13 Reasons Why and the film and everything. And then I had that book that I had to read.
That doesn't help, does it?
No, it does not. So I didn't care for it. I think there were some moments of brilliance, like the Leaves of Grass throughout. Frankly, the detective and him talking about, you know, the balloons, mm-hmm. and some of these metaphors that pop up. And I would also say that long discussion at the end between Q and Margot. There are, like I said, some great moments. But overall, I guess I was just getting annoyed, which, of course, you know, I emailed Tom on our business accounts and said, like, man, you know, I'm just finding cute, like, it's just like, my gosh. And Tom just wrote back in his own cheeky way, you know, they are teenagers. I think that's a direct quote.
He's a teenager,
and I suppose that is true. Like, mm-hmm. perhaps maybe they're not meant to be likable, and that's just like the purpose of it, but there are just like some things. I think my greatest grievance, what I wrote to you, was like, I can't believe he thinks all these coups are for him, when I was on whatever page. But we'll talk about it. Yeah. So I think it's like borderline, but I'll just shift because it's like it could go either way, but I'll say no this time.
Okay. So this is the second time I've read it. I really, really liked it the first time. Although I remember not liking the ending the first time. I don't know why. Maybe it was the long conversation or something, or I was just, or maybe I misinterpreted it or something like that. This time around, I still liked it. I saw its flaws a lot more than I did the first time. And I actually really did like the ending a lot more than I remember. And maybe it's because I spent so much time prepping for the last episode with happy endings.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
That this, to me, I was like, glad that it ends the way it ends. Because it felt that felt real to me. And it wouldn't have felt real to me. It also wouldn't have, if the whole point of the book is for them to realize the real them, like see each other for or him to see himself and especially her as a real person as opposed to what he's built up in his mind, then they're not supposed to get together at the end. That's the whole point, right? Mm-hmm. So that's what I really liked about it. But no, I saw a lot of the flaws in it. He annoyed me quite a bit. The mystery of it all was still compelling to me. I thought the way Green structured the mystery was fun, because it is like it is very Scooby-Doo, right? You know, and it's very almost like, you know, you catch this and catch that, and Radar's the Velma and Lacey's the Daphne, and, you know, and I think out of all the guy characters, I like Radar the most.
I would agree.
Ben, I found even more annoying because Ben was just this like very, very stereotypical horn dog guy character who's kind of a tool. But I think everybody's got that friend, at least from my experience as a teenage boy. And Lacey is a character I liked as well. So we can get into those. But I did like it. But again, I see it much more flawed. I think you gave it like a 3-star rating. On Goodreads, I'd probably go about 3.5. Myself.
Man, I wish Goodreads had halves.
So, but I think it's a really cool concept and premise for a book, though, and I will give him a lot of credit. And one other thing, John, if you're listening, you have my f-ing career, John. I just like. I look at this and I'm like, God, I could have wrote this. That's what drives me nuts. And I'm being partially facetious. I'm like, I could have totally wrote this book. And I like, this is the type of stuff as a teenager that I totally would have wanted to write and read. But I grew up in the early 90s and they were not writing these types of books in the early 90s. So I had to settle for like John Hughes films. And stuff like that. But like, you know, so a little bit of jealousy on my part, creative jealousy on my part. But that's it. But the other thing was, and we're going to get into Q. I think I give Q a pass more than you probably do. Because I read that and I read him and I read his thoughts. And that is me at 17.
Okay.
Like, I'm not kidding. I'm like, there's so, except for the fact that I did want to go to prom. And I wasn't as much of an outcast, and I wasn't as much of the sort of like, you know, oh, I'm too good for high school type of thing. But so much of him, I'm like, oh my God, this is me when I was 17 or 18 years old. So I felt seen in a big way, but I really identified with this kid.
Do you feel like you would be hyperfixated on something to such an extent that it's kind of other things fall to the wayside? Relationships in particular?
Yeah, okay. I had a girlfriend my senior year who her and then my friends, she couldn't stand any of them. For lack of a better word, it was very, very complicated. And it was very stressful for me to do the balancing act between, you know, staying with my friends and being a good friend to them and being kind of like absorbed in this relationship, my first serious relationship with a girl. Now I have not talked to her in almost 30 years and I still talk to some of them. So guess who won? But,
Oh my God.
But yes, I used to have massive crushes on girls, you know. Not to the point where I was like examining every little thing they did, but I certainly had like this one girl I had a crush on for like years. I had her schedule memorized.
Whoa.
Well, to be fair, I was like in 3 or 4 of her classes every year because we were both honor students. So I pretty much like knew, you know, it was not hard to see where she was going to be going every day because we were, you know, we were in the same kind of cohort, but I do remember, being the type of person who could read into things, but I was so shy in some regard that I probably never let anybody know that I was reading into things like that. So maybe not even my friends.
Yeah, I mean, I was one of those people who would always like point out different interactions to other people, more so for them than me, like coming up with reasons like, I think he likes you. This, yeah, I know. it's very true. Well, this is insight into the character of Tom. This is, when did you write that poem about the vomitus? Was it around this time?
It was before I started dating that girl I mentioned, and I had a very brief, like literally dated for like 2 or 3 weeks, this girl who was a very good friend of mine and still is. I'd had a crush on her for a while, and it was the first time I'd ever actually dated somebody, as opposed to just kind of, you know, made out with somebody here and there. And you know, like never had a relationship, and it didn't last very long, but I was like, it was the first time I ever really felt like heartbroken. And I wrote, and I was taking creative writing. So don't break up with me when I take creative writing. But yeah, so that was around. So the vomit poem was a breakup from the previous one and stuff. I wrote some terrible love poetry to this girl, though, to the girl I ended up dating.
Maybe your unpublished novel should be centered around this terrible love poetry.
If I have it, I don't even know. I probably actually still have a file of it somewhere because I you know, it's one of those like things that ended up on a disk drive somewhere that just has migrated over the years. Like, I still have papers from college, so I probably have a file of old poetry and stuff like that. I know I have notebooks of creative writing from high school. So enough about me, Stella. I'll pay the copay tomorrow and talk to my therapist anyway, so I don't need to talk about me too much.
We're just getting you warmed up.
No, let's talk about Q because there are things I like about him. I think his insight into things, even if it is misguided sometimes, is really good. I think does his best to be loyal. I have sympathy for him because he's obviously going through a hard time. Margot aside, he is going through a really hard time letting go of his childhood, his adolescence, and trying to seem like it doesn't bother him. He and his friends, like, they're going to split apart. I mean, there's just a lot coming down the road for him, and he's obviously not handling it well. And this thing with Margot is just kind of a way for it to manifest itself. So that's where I feel for him. At the same time, he is annoying. He is really annoying. He's overly fixated, but again, a teenage boy's, you know, it's that's a very adolescent thing, though. Like, so that's where I give him a little bit of a pass. It's like, well, of course you're reading into these things. And yeah, there are times where I'm like, you're not the best of friends to these people. So he is complicated, and I don't think that he's, as the review described, milk toast or two dimensional. I feel like there's actually a lot of him, and it's more layered than it seems at first. What about you?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I will give him credit where credit is due, that the guy's taking Latin. So, you know, I do appreciate when he's like, well, I've got, you know, this Ovid test tomorrow. I'm like, well, you go, Q.
I thought of you. The minute I saw Ovid, I'm like, oh, Stella.
Yeah, so it's interesting, though, because John Green really sets up that Q is intelligent. Mm-hmm. The Latin, obviously, and then getting into Duke is no easy feat. And, you know, as a side question, I do wonder if someone of average intelligence would have been able to, like, figure out all of this. But I think, to, you know, being a type A personality, which we could potentially assign to him, I think lends itself well to being fixated on this particular mystery. Yeah. And the mystery is interesting. I think just what gets me is that he believes all the clues are for him. And I think really the only ones he could say are the Woody Guthrie poster, because that window is facing his window. Yeah. And then the poem which leads to his door jam.
The mini mall address and the door jam, yeah.
Yeah, so I guess he has, like, extrapolated, and then, like, this is all of it, you know? And then throughout just assigning kind of these characteristics and qualities to Margot and getting an idea of who she is, but really just through this male mouthpiece, which I didn't care for. But then at the end, Margot does have a voice and kind of gives him what for, of like, you had this idea. I didn't want you to come here. I took down that map, you know, on purpose so that I'd be kind of left alone. Yeah. And just, yeah, the way he treats his friends in particular, I would say Ben. And Ben can be annoying, the honey bunny business.
Yeah, who says
hopefully
that?
We can stop him before, yeah, we get to his toxic masculinity. I do actually really like Lacey, even though she does not have much of, like, space on page. Yeah. But I feel like she can temper him and, like, because when he's talking about, like, the huge size of his testicles, she's like, you need to stop. But he goes off on Ben and gets annoyed at him. And then Radar comes in and tells Q, like, you have this idea of how you expect these people to be, but you just need to, like, let them be who they are, which I think spoke holistically to the novel and kind of also spoke to how Q was treating Margot. We know that Q has these therapist parents, so it seems like he's well-adjusted. But you're right that he, you know, it's his hatred for Prom is so great that there's got to be something going on, you know, under the surface.
Yeah.
And I think that he's just been following what he believes he needs to do his entire life. That what I do like for him is this mystery. I don't condone necessarily lying to your parents, but for once he's actually acting, I think, like a teenager should. Mm-hmm. You know, taking off in the middle, going on this spontaneous road trip. He skipped class, didn't he, like, miss school? Oh, they all did. They called in sick, and he had, like, perfect attendance.
Yeah.
But then he realized, like, oh, that, you know, doesn't necessarily matter. So he became, I think, the person that Margot really wanted him to become, which is why she brought him initially on that adventure with the 11 things
the
that they were going
night.
To do. Is, yeah, like, just be this other person that I can see you. I think the quote was, like, you're cute when you're confident, but not when you're not, you know? And so kind of coming into his own, maybe, or at least something that was locked in within him. Now, some of the brilliant moments, like I said, that John Green writes, there was one, and I wish I should have, like, labeled what page it was. It might have been when he was going to these different subdivisions. But just some of these moments where Q is, like, sitting, maybe, like, considering the dead man that they found when they were children, mm-hmm. or things like that, that are really, like, well thought out and well written. But it took me out because I'm like, is this actually Q, though, or is this, like, too much John Green giving it to Q? Because everything else is like, okay, Q is pretty down to earth, even though he is intelligent. But then we have these big moments, especially at the end. I think that speech, which I do really like, I shouldn't say speech, but the conversation between Margot and Q,
yeah.
He says some really deep things, and I like it, but I also wonder, is it, you know, is it Q? Did you feel like you were taken out at all? Like, oh, you know, this is a bit highbrow for him. Would it be more what the detective, you know, would say? Because I really liked what the detective had to say about the balloons and, you know, don't spend your time, or the people who spend their time looking up at the balloons suddenly, like, become one. You know, I really liked what he had to say about those sorts of things. So mixed feelings about Q. But I think potentially he's not meant to be 100% likable, both with what you had to say that, yeah, he is a teenager. And I'm also coming to realize, like, characters in any form of media especially with women, don't necessarily have to be likable. Like, that is just, you know, their character, flaws and all.
Yeah. Well, and to paraphrase Walt Whitman, Q contains multitudes. No, he's intelligent but immature, and I think that's one of the things that causes what we see, where he doesn't know how to deal with any of this. So the immaturity is the lashing out and the rebellion and the pushing aside of the Holden type of stuff, where he's pushing aside all the things that are kind of like phony in a sense, where his friends who are kind of the same way. His friends are dorks too, right? But they're like, you know, I'm going to lean into this and I'm going to enjoy this because this is the last time I'm going to be able to do it. So let's, if you're going to, you know, if you're going to be in high school, let's just finish high school. Like, you know, let's go in. And so when he has the conversation at the end, yes, it's a little bit of Green kind of trying to make sure his point gets across. So I think bits and pieces of it are clunky, but I also, you know, the conversation as it is, I think works because of the fact that, I don't know if this would have come from any of the other guys in the group, because, Radar is like very intelligent and actually pretty mature. Ben is completely emotionally mature, and Quinn's kind of both. So that emotional maturity is necessary, I think, to have to reach the conclusion, because that's how you get the growth that you need. And I think that, you know, you won't want a completely unlikable protagonist, but you want a complicated one. I think sometimes, you know, we spent a lot of time talking about stuff, romance stuff, and we talked about book talk. And I think sometimes when I haven't been on TikTok in a very long time now, when I would come across book talk stuff, sometimes I want to ask, but I never do because I don't want to get flamed. Why is there such a demand for a sort of perfection among protagonists sometimes? Mm-hmm. Like, you need a complicated, flawed, and sometimes a bit unlikable protagonist if the novel is going to have growth, and if they're going to have growth, and they're supposed to make mistakes and do wrong things, and I think on some level annoy the heck out of you. Now, it doesn't always work, you know? Sometimes the person is unlikable and you know, you're like, oh, well, I don't really like him. You know, it's okay. You know, and you don't have to like everything. You don't have to think everything is perfect, and you don't dismiss anything that somebody else likes. My point being, he is unlikable in a number of places, but at the same time, again, the compelling story and then the conclusion reached at the end, you know, I don't know how I like him a little more. And I still have a lot of empathy for this guy. And I think it's the people I think she's a big part of it too. So, but yeah, some of the stuff and the stuff that he extrapolates, like, oh, this is definitely about me. Again, I've been there as well. Just never, as forethought about it, forward about it, yeah. And stuff like that. Does the word, a word that is very, has been very popular, thankfully I don't hear it as much as I was a few years ago, but the word problematic got thrown around a lot, right? And I've seen it applied to teen entertainment of the past, usually from like my generation, because, you know, people's views on things change. So what you thought was a romantic gesture in a movie is seen as stalking or problematic. And I'm like, no, but anyway,
like we talked about John Logan following Grace last time.
Yeah.
And that, yeah. On one side it's like, that could be problematic.
Like,
yeah.
You know, like I've literally seen people talk about Cusack holding up the boombox and saying anything. It's, he's stalking her. It's like, no. Would this be seen as problematic the way he goes after her, or is it not? And is that just a?
Yeah. So I guess in a similar vein of that question, I've been thinking about what his motivations are. Is it like completely romantic and trying to find her and rescue the damsel in distress, or is he 100% concerned with her safety? I think that Lacey is 100. I feel like she's really concerned.
Yes.
That's like her full investment. I think that's why she gets really pissed off at the end, as anyone would, because of everything. And then Margot is like really ungracious towards them.
I think Margot calls her up. Or they have a conversation over the phone. It seems like they at least settle that to some degree.
Yes, it does get better. But like the initial Lacey walks away and is like, you're a total bitch.
Yeah.
And then I'm like, you're right, Lacey.
Yeah, definitely.
I fully agree.
We'll get to Margot, trust me.
Yeah. So that's, I, you know, kind of, and he's complex enough to say that I think it could be both and. And so in this case, I feel like I'm going to say it's like borderline. It's like yes and no. I think there are some unhealthy fixations when he's in the troll room or like the troll tunnel is in that dilapidated building, and like really fixated on smell, which of course we've talked about scents and sensory memories and things like that. But you know, like that can get, you know, a little bit creepy. But I think he does worry because he does think about and has noticed both in their 11 things to do that she was sad. She sat up at the SunTrust Tower. And then also when they find that accidentally, because she painted over it because she didn't want to found the if you go to Paper Towns, you won't return or whatever that is, which sounds like really ominous.
Yeah.
That there's like general concern that, you know, she might not make it out alive. And then, of course, when she comments on that post on the Omnictionary that there'll be a citizen of one until such and such a time. What does that mean? Is she going to kill herself at that time and that's it? Is she moving away? So there's like a sense of urgency. So I think it is a both and unhealthy fixation, but also there are cries for help that you can absolutely see. And you don't know until, of course, Margot says, oh, you were all wrong about it. But you don't know. And it's better to try that and fail and be wrong about it than not do anything and have that person's life on your hands.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. And I think it is. And I think on some level, he doesn't necessarily know what his full motivation is, too, because he is clearly in love with this girl, or he's in love with the idea of this girl. Mm-hmm. And but at the same time, he's known her in some capacity since they were little kids. And he is reading into this. But I think with some of the things like you talked about with the Paper Towns quote and the thing at the end, especially, I think you could very well read that into that, that she is going to harm herself and that you would be legitimately worried for her. So I don't think that, you know, it's completely out of line for him to see if he can, you know, find her. And I think on some level he thinks he's rescuing her. And I think when she calls him out for that, she's right. But also he discovers the stuff at the mini mall. The scent thing, borderline, I agree. But when he's catching it so much in places that otherwise smell awful, it makes sense to me. Like, because there are certain scents you associate with certain people anyway. Like, I caught every once in a while, going back to this girlfriend I had as senior of high school, every once in a while I catch a whiff of somebody's shampoo and it's whatever she used to use. Like,
herbal essences?
It's something like that, right? And it's just like, holy crap. It's the one memory. I have like very few, like, memories, sense memories of her because it's been so long. That's one of them. And it'll just trigger it for a second because I'm like, holy crap. So him recognizing that from Margot is not completely out of the question. It's not like he's keeping something around or whatever. The other thing that also this is really important too, is you bring up the suicide aspect. The entire time he's looking for her after he finds the mini mall, which she had basically, she said, this was like, I was willing this to you. Like, this is where you could go, all guys could go all hang out. Yeah. And so, which is very weird to me, but
especially since it's like filled with this.
Yeah. It's just like, this place is falling apart. And like I'm like, good God, my allergies. But I was feeling, I was starting to get a sore throat reading it. He goes around subdivisions, like pseudo-divisions that, you know, were either halted in development or never fully developed, and he's looking for her as she's there. And every time he goes there, he thinks he's finding her body because this all sounds like it. And I think it's a very realistic thought for him. It's one he doesn't want to have, and it's scary. And I think it's one of the other reasons he keeps obsessing over, because he's very scared that that's what he's going to find, and he doesn't want to find that. And he's keeping the hope that she's alive. And I agree with you, Lacey is coming out of it, especially since that she had the reason she went after Jace because he was cheating on her.
Yep.
She went after Becca because Jace was cheating on her with Becca. The reason she went after Lacey is because, why didn't Lacey tell me about this? And later on, after she disappears and Lacey finally like talks to Q and Ben about it. And she says, and he, you know, she finds out this is why Margot did this. Lacey's like, I never knew.
Yeah.
So, and I that kind of clues you into to Margot being like, also being a very selfish character. You know, communication is not always the best among teenagers anyway. So again, that's realistic. We don't communicate very well as people. What this comes to me about is when I wrote for one of our questions, which has like, which has a subletters. I said, when it comes to the characters and even the situation, Green's deliberately playing around with tropes of this genre, of the teen genre. So the plot, it's a last great adventure type of story, the last great night of high school. And you have to remember, this came out around the same time as movies like Superbad. So this sort of type of character or type of group of friends to do the crazy thing and stuff, it was in the zeitgeist. And so this is why it didn't strike me as weird that he would write a story like this. And this type of last crazy adventure that we're all going to have before we all head out, or we're going to have that one great night before I head off to college, goes way back. I talked on my other podcast, Pop Culture Affidavit, if you're interested in listening to it, with Rob Kelly last year about American Graffiti, which was a 1972 movie directed by an obscure director that nobody's ever heard of named George Lucas, that is about the last night before these people. Now they're all boomers, so whatever, but these people who are actually more close to my parents' age go off to college. And it ends with Richard Dreyfuss taking off in a plane headed back east to college because they're in California. And the whole idea is them out one last night, and there's a drag race and everything. And then fast forward to 1993, and I talked with Amanda the next episode about Dazed and Confused. And then I talked to Bailey about The Big Chill, which is almost the nostalgia version of that stuff. But it's like this idea of you have that one last night, let's make it happen, has been around at least in film for a couple of generations now. There was a movie that came out a couple of
years. Your favorite movie.
What?
Your favorite movie.
And what's that?
It has Jennifer Love Hewitt in it.
Oh, Can't Hardly Wait. It's not my favorite.
Isn't that a last hurrah, too?
It's the big senior year party, right?
Yeah.
My favorite movie is The Breakfast Club, by the way. That is not it.
But
you know, and there's John Hughes-isms in this. There was a movie that came out a couple of years ago. I have not seen it. It's in my Hulu queue and I keep meaning to watch it. Booksmart with Beanie Feldstein and
directed
by Olivia Wilde, which is kind of the same thing, right? You know, it's so this idea, he's playing with this trope, and then he's got tropey characters on purpose, I think. Q being the lovelorn, lovesick guy. He's the Ethan Embry in Can't Hardly Wait, right? Lauren Ambrose would have made a hell of a Margot. Yes. Because now I'm picturing Denise and Can't Hardly Wait. I'm like, oh, she would have been a great Margot. Ben's the horny sidekick. Radar's the brainiac. Lacey, the hot girl who's actually a good person. She's like Andy in the Goonies, you know, like the really cute girl who falls in with the dorks. And then Margot Roth Spiegelman, and we have to say her names like that, like she's Jordan Catalano or something, right? Is a deconstruction. First of all, she's the crush, right? So actually, Jordan Catalano is a good comparison because the way Angela is obsessed with him through 19 episodes of my so-called life is very, very Q and Margot, except Jordan's not nearly as bright, and he is played by Jared Leto, so meh. But and this is the question, getting through all this, we get down to the trope, we get to the big trope. She is, according to Green, and I can totally see this, a deconstruction of the manic pixie dream girl. And he said so. He said that he deliberately made her like this so that he could do a deconstruction of that character. Listeners, if you are not sure what a manic pixie dream girl is, here's the definition. It was coined by the AV Club's Nathan Rabin in a review for the movie Elizabethtown, which was a Cameron Crowe film, which is terrible, by the way. And I can't believe how far Cameron Crowe, who directed one of my favorite movies of all time, has fallen. Anyway, it's a character who exists solely in the fevered imaginations of sensitive writer-directors to teach broodingly soulful young men to embrace life and its infinite mysteries and adventures. And more of it, importantly, she doesn't really have much of a character arc. Often she actually is a girlfriend in a refrigerator as well, because like she ceases at some point sometimes. The two best examples I can think of, sometimes they end up with the guy, by the way. The two best examples I can think of for film are the trope namer, which is Kirsten Dunst's character in Elizabethtown, who is the manic pixie dream girl for Orlando Bloom, I think is the male lead in that movie. And then, I think this is right around the same time, the one that I think of more than any of them, more than Kirsten Dunst, is Natalie Portman in Garden State, starring Zach Braff. Now the reviewer has since disowned the term, but because he thinks it's overused and incorrectly applied, but it does tend to be a good critique of lazy writing. There's another book that comes out. I'm rambling. I apologize. There's another book that comes up in conjunction with Paper Towns because they came around the same time, which is by Larry Doyle. It's called I Love You, Beth Cooper. And it is a guy has the hots for this cheerleader and they have the wild night together after, et cetera, et cetera. But she's not Manny Pixie Dream Girl. She's like really there's a lot about her and it's a whole other book. But so if Margot's supposed to be a deconstruction of this trope, does he pull it off?
Jeez. You in the past, however long you were talking, dropped so many things. There's like so many comments. To go back to something you said about Lacey, I do want to say that another complaint Margot had about Lacey is that she makes offhand kind of body shaming comments, which I don't know if this was just another thing that John Green wanted to add to make it so that Lacey wasn't 100% innocent.
Yeah.
Because it does come up again, and Q is like, oh, I see what Margot is talking about.
Margot's supposed to not be, is supposed to be a little more curvy than like stick figure Lacey, which is why I think she was cast in the movie.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. In regards to Booksmart, I've seen that and liked it. It is a bit like crude, but I think in like teenagers in those films, you can kind of expect it. But what's really interesting is that these people who are like going to Ivy Leagues they decided like we're going to go to our first and last party. And then throughout the course of the night, they see all these other people who have been partying their entire like high school career are also going to Ivy League. So they're like, what the heck? We just missed out on that.
It's,
okay.
It's Diane. It's Diane Court at the party didn't say anything.
I enjoyed it.
I'll have to
one
watch
of my friends
it.
Did not, but
to watch it.
Yeah, I think it's on Hulu. So, okay. So I did look up Manic Pixie Dream Girl. You are probably the only person in my life that references it frequently. Honestly, this is not the first time on the show that you've brought it up. So I, went on Wikipedia to see it. And in addition to your definition, they were also saying that this woman is made up of many different quirky personality types. Mainly adds dimension to the male character. And then they actually went through people in the past that were assigned that. Katherine Hepburn in Bringing Up Baby. Like, there are some weird things that I'm like, I don't know if I fully get on board with that. Zooey Deschanel's character in 500 Days of Summer. So, like, there were different people. So now I'm thinking about, okay, your definition of, like, deconstruction and everything. I feel like when you – correct me if I'm wrong, but when you deconstruct something, you're, like, pulling apart the pieces of it in order to analyze kind of – like its makeup and see if it holds true. But should you also in your deconstruction create the thing that you're trying to deconstruct?
I think that on some level it's supposed to be on it. I would imagine on its surface, it's supposed to look like the thing you're taking apart so that you can recognize what it is and then take it apart. Right? Now it doesn't have to be 100% like it can have the appearance of it, but it doesn't have to be the trope. Like, it just needs to look like it enough so that we can take it apart. and find what's underneath.
So then,
at least that's my interpretation of what he's doing.
Okay. So going on that, and I believe your question was, is he successful in this deconstruction? Yeah. Okay. Now I ask you, what does it look like to pull that off? So I would say for 95% of the novel, Margot would be what that definition of manic pixie dream girl is. It's fully in that ride along on that evening where they're going everywhere, like quirky personality, and she's trying to bring Quentin out. And you have this idea of her, but Quentin's really the one who's growing throughout. So it's like, okay, this is it. But then you get to that last 5% and you get to see what her actual like intentionality is, her motives and who she really is. And I think that's when it kind of breaks apart and you're like, oh, she does have her own character. But she still is like, the purpose of it is to see Q's development. So in that way, I feel like he may have failed. So yeah, I'm interested to see, cause you're the one who talks about these girls. So I'm interested to see what you have to say, cause I'm a bit on the fence on whether or not he quote unquote pulls it off.
If I'm grading on an A through F scale, I think he gets a B.
Okay.
I agree with you on everything of like, he definitely sets her up at this. She's not Natalie Portman in Garden City. She's kind of like Kat Dennings in Nick and Nora's Infinite Playlist. She's like, she's cool. Like, he also thinks she's pretty cool and she's doing all this cool stuff. Right. So you need somebody which she's got more of an attitude than sort of like the silly pixie girl. Like Zooey Deschanel would never play her. But if they never have the conversation at the end of the book, it doesn't work, right? He fails. I think the conversation is what gets him to that B, but he doesn't get an A because it kind of ends there, and we still just have Q. We don't have enough of her, and we don't have enough of her after that because it's like – because then you start thinking like, I know that she has done this before and she's run away and she's done stuff, but like we never get any insight as to like why her parents are so ready to just get rid of her. And
it's kinda nuts.
Like, you know, is there a mental health issue is such a bad way to put it, but like, you know, what is she suffering from? You know, she points out that she built up this persona at school because it's what she needed to do in order to get through it. Right. And so she kept up the facade of the mirage and she was eventually sick of it. It was why she kept running away. It was one of the reasons she kept running away, because it was just like to escape. And then she's making this final escape. And I can see that. But I wanted more of Margot to fully understand Margot. I get the point that he makes at the end. He's like, yeah, she was just a girl and not Margot Roth Spiegelman. And I think he succeeds at that. But I think he could have gone a little farther with her. It's almost like it demands a retelling or some sort of sequel or some sort of extra chapter or something from Margot's perspective. And
or from her sister's perspective.
Or we need – there are pieces in the puzzle that are not in the box. And I think that's why I said I give him a B, because I think he does a great job of it. I think he pulls the rug out from under the manic pixie dream girl in that scene at the end. And I think the conversation is a great one.
Yeah.
But I think that it's missing some things.
Don't you think the deconstruction should be the entire length of something?
Probably. I don't know. I mean, I'm not – I would imagine so. I guess it depends on what you're trying to –
I don't want it to seem like an afterthought, I guess. It's just like he's writing this whole thing. He's like, whoops, I forgot to do this.
I think this was deliberate on his part. I think he wanted to lead us along this because we're doing it through Q's eyes. If it was a third-person narrator – and we got multiple perspectives, then I think he would have had this inserted a lot earlier and we would have been kind of led to this point, but we would have known that Margot is not what she seems. We get hits and bits and pieces of it there. And I think we're starting to put those pieces together ourselves and like, dude, you have built this girl up to something that she is totally not. and she confirms it. But and I think so. I think he is doing it, but he does a very, very long setup. And he does lead us down that path because he has to. But when he gets to the point, he does a very good job of what he does. But we need more in order to finish it. You know, he almost completely sticks the landing.
Almost.
And the reason I say he sticks and he trips a little bit, but he recovers. And I say that because they do not get together at the end.
Which I don't think they should.
No, no. It's such a bittersweet moment at the end because they kiss and they're just standing there together. And you know, this isn't like Molly Ringwald running off to Andrew McCarthy or Eric Stoltz running off to Mary Stuart Masterson in Some Kind of Wonderful. Is the Eric Stoltz, yeah, Mary Stuart Masterson movie. Love that movie. Covered it on my show. Love that movie. But that's
oh my gosh, you're plugging.
I have seen so many teen movies and covered them. I love that movie, but it is a total happy ending, right? It's fairy tale. This is not a fairy tale. Yeah. And I think he does a really good job with that. But yeah, I think that it's missing something on her part. And what do you think of her anyway? Yeah, as a character, is she worth all this? Is she a good character?
Oh, boy.
Like, as you get through all of this and getting to know her and such and finally meet her, like, what is your opinion of Margot Roth Spiegelman?
Yes, I'm sure in high school, because I did definitely try to chase popularity to a certain extent and fit in within certain circles and be less of a trendsetter and more of a follower, that I would probably, you know, try to be friends with Margot. I like the fact, because I think looking at one detail, I'd be like, oh, she seems like she could be a somewhat decent person, in that she is able to almost like silently protect many groups, mm-hmm, of people. And you only see this because once she's gone, there's a void. And that's when crazy, yes, stuff happens. Like that one guy runs over a bunch of bikes. Someone sprays pee on another person. Using,
yeah, like all hell breaks loose at the school. She's not,
yes,
there.
Yes. And so like she's been holding them together, you know, holding people together, but she is not. Again, I think John Green, like you said, you know, at the top of this, that everyone has flaws within, mm-hmm, this book, because she apologizes to Q because I think she did not say yes to him for the middle school dancing thing where the girls, yeah, had to say yes. And one of the guys, I think the one who lost his eyebrow, convinced everyone to say
Chuck.
No to him, and he, yeah, started
Chuck,
crying.
Chuck was,
yeah,
Chuck was so, Q's bully. He even threw Q into the cafeteria conveyor belt or something.
Yes, yeah. So I think, you know, there's something to be said about someone who uses whatever strange power they have for the good, to like keep groups, you know, separate and to have some modicum of peace within the crazy, mm-hmm, world we call high school. Inadvertently, she is able to, yeah, push Q to fill that role, and he's able to be bolder and more confident than he normally would. I can understand someone suffering under weird parental pressures. We do not understand these fully from the book and what we are given, because we don't have a perspective. A-holes is frequently the modifier that is used within, yeah, the book. And even Q's parents have issues with like that. And obviously saying like she's welcome here is a big thing. So if she feels the need to flee, you know, there's got to be some reason. Mm-hmm. At the same time, there's a lot of parental worry, because it's not the first time that she's fled. She went to Mississippi. Yeah. They're living in Florida, and she was however young, much younger then. So she's a complex character. Maybe there might be some like mental health thing there. I don't really know. I think one of our questions is like, should we diagnose?
Yeah.
Probably not. It might just be like she's kind of like a free spirit. But it's interesting to find her in that space where she's in this triangular cubicle, which of course doesn't make sense. And just writing down furiously is like, man, this is like the making of a Unabomber, like writing a manifesto and a thing. So there's like something going on there. But I feel like, yeah, maybe she is just like one of these cliched, like really misunderstood people that's got a lot going on in her mind. The way that she like cross hatches, maybe I like this a little bit more than I thought I did, because there are really intriguing mm-hmm. things of like her cross hatching, how she's writing in her journal so like only trained people can figure out what she's writing. But I don't like what she did, or rather didn't do, to her sister, because I feel like there's some sort of relationship there. But the fact that she didn't even tell her sister or reach out to her, which she does do better at the end, I think she calls her. But even the mom was like, what did the mom say? The mom said something really bad about like, don't come home or something like that. Like, we don't want you here. It was like something really bad. So perhaps the healthiest thing for her was to leave. Should she have left in the way or in the manner that she did? Maybe not. Or at least like let some people know so that they don't think that you have unalived yourself. But yeah, I mean, I would say that she's really complex. My only thing is like, I wish we could have learned about her from her own point of view versus through everyone else, or, you know, through these different gazes, through these different vignettes where she's not even present, but people are talking about her. But perhaps the detective had like the best clue as to, you know, who she is like this balloon that's up there.
Yeah. She calls her mom. And it's one-sided, so we don't actually hear what her mom says.
Yeah.
But, you know, she feels bad about what she did to her sister, Ruthie, that she just left without giving, you know.
I think she did. Didn't she say to Q what her mom told her?
I think so.
She changed the locks. That's the first thing she said. Isn't that nuts?
Yeah. And I was saying that earlier. Like, yeah, it's just so I don't know what was going on there. We also don't know. Did they ever hint at – I don't think he ever hints at what Margot's future actually is supposed to be. Like
– No. I mean, she's going to New York
City. No. I mean, like, not the one she's planning, but the one that was essentially planned for her. Where was she accepted into college? Like, had she stayed in Orlando and gone on the prescribed path, where was she supposed to end up? That sort of thing. I don't mm-hmm. know if we got that sense, and I don't even know if Quentin knew, because he's been so, he is sort of like far in orbit of all these people in that sense. Yeah. She's an intriguing person, but she's also kind of a brat. And it's kind of what you like about her, because in the very least, that flaw and the immaturity of her is so true to what this would be. I mean, like, you know, he correctly calls her out for what mm-hmm. she's done, and her friends call her out. Like, this isn't something that's cool. You know, it's kind of cool and mysterious when she ran off the other times, but she came back and they're like, oh, wow. It's like it built up the myth of Margot Roth-Spiegelman, but this is different. And when the reality of it sets in, I think for his friends, they get it quicker than he does. And then he eventually gets it, and he's pretty pissed off. And I think we would be the right with him. It's like, what the hell is your problem?
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, she's running from something too. And that's the other thing. Like, what are you running from, and are you ever going to confront it? And how is you going to solve that problem?
Yeah. Do you feel like she's, you know, to harken back to a previous episode, can't remember her name, but Carrie, kind of the nice person,
Sue Snell?
The novel. Yeah. Do you think it's kind of that where she really didn't want to be in this, this idea, the society's idea of what, you know, life should be like and what your future should be like and all that sort of thing?
I could, she is definitely of that type, because she strikes me as somebody who wouldn't want to be a mean girl to people like him maybe got caught up in things from time to time. It actually was nicer than people like Becca, for instance, and such. So, yeah, I agree with you on that. She says, like, I think the line we were talking about earlier, may you go to the paper towns and never come back. And, like, you know, again, that all leads to the suicide there. And her parents, you know, and his parents are just kind of funny because in an ironic way, they don't actually get any of this, yet they are psychologists and they always talk about psychology. And it's kind of funny in that sense. And I think they're there for that comic relief, sort of. I mean, one of the funniest moments is they give him a car for his graduation present, and they give him a Ford minivan because he liked driving ours so much, like not realizing that the reason he kept driving theirs is because it was the only car to drive.
Yes!
And so like they made this weird conclusion that he must want a minivan. And I laughed out loud at that scene. I'm like, that is so funny. Of course it becomes like, you know, the mystery machine in the back half of the novel. But,
with the different layers of a house.
I like that. That was funny. That was funny. You know, Q and Margot are connected by this dead body at the beginning. They're playing in the park, and they come across this guy, and he has shot himself. And I think he was either having an affair, he was in deep financial trouble or something, and he had done that. And his wife was divorcing him. And she says something to the extent of, like, all the strings inside of him broke.
Yeah.
I liked that particular metaphor that Green kept coming back to, the idea that you have these strings inside you and they were breaking, because that's what Q was trying to follow in her. And hold on, I think Green worked that really, really well. What about you?
Yeah, I agree. And I think it connects to the balloon talk inadvertently with the detective as well. But yeah, I mean, kind of things shred within us, I think. And we talk about getting on our last nerve, you know, jokingly. But honestly, there's like so much we can take as human beings sometimes. And if you don't have a good support system, which she did not, then it's going to be trouble.
What's interesting about her, too, is that I could see her being, had she stayed around instead of going to New York, but had she gone to college, I could see her having a transformation of some sort in college where she would come back to high school and nobody would recognize her, in the sense that she would totally not have the same attitude, because being completely gone from the role she had to play, she could reinvent herself. But I don't think she wanted to wait, or I don't know if she even gone to college. That's the thing. Like, we don't know where she was supposed to be headed because she just went ahead.
Yeah.
The other thing I kind of found funny is that with all their sleuthing ability, nobody learns the definition of a paper town as it applies to Algo, New York, until the last possible moment. Like, he assumes that it's all these pseudo divisions and stuff, and he's gone around Florida, and then what's this map and blah, blah, blah. And he finally kind of starts putting all the omnictionary things together and all this stuff, and realizes that, oh wait, I've been looking in the wrong place, and the definition of a paper town is this. It's like literally like a town put on a map by a company to avoid people swiping it. It's a copyright thing. And I was just like, wait. And the first time I saw it, I was like, oh, this is such a cool concept. The second time I read it, I was like, wait, it took you this long. I don't remember it taking this long for you to figure that out. I just thought that was kind of funny. I'm like, you guys really are dumb. But they're teenagers, right? So sometimes they don't think things
are wrong.
I guess as we get through this, Q's friends at the end of the novel are finally fed up and walk away. And Lacey talks to Margot, and Margot, they seem to patch things up at least to a certain extent, where Margot was like, I was very scared, I'm very sorry, I shouldn't have done that. At least the reaction that she had when she saw them. I don't think that their friendship is fully repaired, but I think that at least a little bit of that wound is healed. But Lacey tells Margot to tell Q that they are leaving in the morning with or without him.
Yep.
Why did they stay with him for so long? Because there were points in the book where I was like, why haven't his friends ditched him completely? Aside from the fact they've been friends for this long, they might as well keep being friends. I mean, it's the only thing I can think of keeping them together, at least him and Ben. Radar seemed a lot more empathetic. But, like, Ben seemed over him. And at the same time, kept coming back. Like, why wasn't Q completely alone by the time they had to go on the road trip? Why did Red, Ben, and Radar go?
Oh, by the time
get to the road trip, why isn't Q doing this by himself? Why are his friends still with him if he's pissed them off so much and ditched them and rejected them and been like, I don't want to deal with this and all these things? Like, why do they turn around and ditch graduation and go with him?
Well, I think that's our reading through Q's lens, our misunderstanding of who these people are. Because he has these expectations, and I think that when it comes down to it, their actual like personalities and identities are good friends, and so they're going to be with him. I think if it were like it was kind of left field, even though he had the evidence to back up what he was saying, and yeah, it's very, especially Lacey, but everyone, I guess maybe it was that kind of last hurrah. Man, what's more important, prom or graduation? Because prom was a big thing. It's to think about graduation being less than prom is interesting. But I think when it comes down to it, even though Q kept failing at his abilities to be what I would consider a good friend, I think that these people kind of model what that looks like. And again, I think there are also different motivations. Like Lacey really wants to be sure that Margot is still alive. I think we could also say that Ben is, you know, along for Lacey and to support him because he's very much, I think he's very much kind of a
boyfriend.
And then Radar is the one, he's like basically, you won't survive this trip without me, because he's the one who calculates the actual trip time, how much they need to stop and everything. Yeah. So, yeah, I think when it comes down to it, everyone almost has a particular role to play in the adventure in the car ride.
Yeah. Speaking of the car ride, what did you think of that? I thought there were some funny moments when they have to do pit stops and they're like timing themselves and it's just like, go.
Yeah.
That was pretty funny. In fact,
it was like missions, because Lacey's like, okay, let's recap who's doing what and when.
It's cinematic in a way, too, that I really, really liked. I mean, Green allows himself to be silly when he needs to. The thing I like about his writing, as tiring as sometimes the thoughts of a teenage boy can get, like sometimes the narration did get to me. Green doesn't seem to take himself too seriously as a writer. And I think that really works in his favor.
Yes. Too much pee. I don't know what's going on with Ben.
Small bladder.
If he needs to, get his, what would it be? What is it when you squeeze on it and in the doctor's office? Starts with a P? Not the pancreas.
Prostate?
I guess it doesn't matter. Yeah, it is a prostate, isn't it? He might need to get that checked. Lacey God. Surrounded by all
She's
of that.
She's not going to survive.
But Ben turns out to be a hero. Because Q just basically is like, Jesus, take the wheel in that moment. And Ben reaches over and pulls it. Which
so they
is,
don't hit the
yeah,
cow. Yeah,
nuts.
Q freezes, basically. He's
yeah.
Like, what the hell? Yeah. And funny is like, I have a question about like how unrealistic the plot is in some ways and whether or not it works, you know, because it is like, we're going to go find this girl and she ran off and there were these clues and stuff. But I think it works because I think it's not supposed to be. I think like he makes it as far out as he can and still grounded in a sense of reality on purpose. So I think he threads that needle really, really well. I wasn't expecting this to be ultra realistic.
Sure.
It's a mystery.
I would say that my parents would be like running out of graduation.
My parents would have killed me.
Absolutely. Or blowing up my phone. There's just like no way that they got out of that unscathed. So that would be something that I would call foul on. Yeah. But yeah.
That would have. I guess the drama of that I understand. But at the same time, this could have been like, I don't know. They could have done graduation and then gone. You know, that to me, it's weird that they skipped the graduation to do it. I guess it just makes it more dramatic and it makes Q is at the height of his worship of Margot at that point because he hasn't realized like who she is and really hasn't learned about who she really is. He's just in his mind like, I've got to get the girl. And so I totally get why Green puts it there, but he could have put it a few hours later. I think it still would have been it still would have worked.
It would, let them have their naked graduation.
Anything else about the ending? Because I think we talked about maturity quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And we talked a lot about the parents and the plot and what Margot and Q kind of discover about each other, or at least what Q discovers about her. We talked about Margot and Lacey. But the end, just like the ending in general, like we both like the ending about how they don't get together. I find it really, really bittersweet and was struck by it way more than I was the first time around. But like the argument and stuff, any other thoughts on that? Like how it was staged, whether or not you think, you know, was there anything else you think about, like how it worked or didn't work and what they say to each other, et cetera?
No, you say it's bittersweet. I feel like there's also like this kind of unsettling tone to it because I think it's one of those like, oh yeah, we'll see each other, and they won't ever see each
Which
other.
Which is very realistic, again. Right? All right.
Yeah. But no, I mean, I like how Margot kind of calls him out and basically like, you made me into like someone that I'm not, or you put like a lot of pressure on me. But at the same time, I think she needs to be called out for kind of her selfish nature and being upset at them for being concerned and coming to see her.
Lacey does that very well.
It's very complex. I think it's a very adult scene, honestly, but with like teenage emotions coming into it and like behavior. I feel like it's really well written. And then just how people, Lacey, as I said, I think she has every right to stamp off. That would be crazy if Q had stayed. I think there's like no reason why. That would have been like wishful, hoping that she was going to change for him.
Well, the other,
But,
No, go ahead.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, I think
sorry, I need to interrupt. I like the fact that it is a very adult moment, but Green's not writing teenagers as if they are little adults. And I think there are too many, now I don't know about books, but there are way too many TV shows and movies, especially from the 90s into the 2000s, where they were so self-aware that they were unrealistically portrayed characters, like, you know, everybody's witty, right? You know, stuff like that. And it was almost like they were trained adults playing teenagers. This doesn't feel like that. This feels like this is actually how teenagers would react to one another, or at least of that time. Who knows that? Yeah, maybe they don't. I think if you give this to a teenager and you ask whether or not teenagers are like this, they're going to tell you no, because they never want to admit. They never want to admit when they feel seen. But I think that this is, I think he writes the kids very well. And he gets the complexity of that age, of the maturity, the immaturity.
Yeah.
So before we get to our last question, I want to know, after the book ends, first of all, what happens to Q's friendships with the guys? How awkward is that 24-hour drive back to Orlando? Because you got to remember, they have to travel back. Yeah. And then what happens to Margot?
what happens to Margo? You know, I was just thinking as you were speaking, and that she found herself in yet another derelict building at the end. I was like, man, this person would probably be homeless just for like the sake of it in New York. Because I don't know what sort of prospect, like, let's be realistic. What sort of prospects does she have in New York?
Yeah.
I feel like she'll just kind of live on the street and be cross hatching away in her journal. And Q will come up to go see a Broadway show and see her panhandling and be like, oh my gosh, Margo, Spiegelman. I don't know. I really don't know. I have worries for her, but I think she's going to live her life. And fingers crossed she's safe. As for their friendship, I think that this is one of those things where, like, you break up immediately afterwards, or it fuses you together forever. Is this the end all and be all for their thing? But I feel like, man, it really was like forged in fire that I'm hoping that he stays with his friends. Angela, who even knows what Angela's going to do with Radar in the film, Angela actually comes along.
I read that
on the ride, which was interesting. So I'm hoping that they do stay together. I hope that now that this fantasy of Margo is gone, that Ben is a better friend. I do know they're going to different universities, so they just have to be, I think, intentional about it. But I think it would always be one of those, like, remember when, like, you know, fantasy. Isn't that kind of like Stand By Me? Wasn't that an adult person thinking back to his childhood? Yeah,
at the end of Stand By Me, talk about a bittersweet moment. As they return to their town, he talks about what happened to the four of them. And he mentions that Teddy and Vern, who are Corey Feldman and Jerry O'Connell, kind of, because they were in junior high in the movie. And he's like, when they go to high school, they kind of drift apart. And I think the phrase he uses is eventually they just both became faces in the halls. And he and Chris, who's played by the late, great River Phoenix, stay together as friends. And then the thing that prompts him for the flashback in Stand By Me is that he reads this newspaper story about his friend, how Chris has been stabbed and killed in a there is a little bit of that. I think they probably make up a little bit more on the 24-hour drive. It's awkward at first, but I think then it becomes like, it's a lot less urgent, and I think it becomes a lot more fun for them. I think they do drift apart, and they stay friends. You know, your friends from high school drift away. Social media has kept, I think, a better tether on a lot of them, at least in my life.
Mm-hmm.
I'm friends with people through Facebook and Instagram from high school who I knew fairly well in classes in school, but like, I don't know. I feel weirdly closer to them now that we're out of that social structure. And then some of my best friends I hear from every once in a while, but we are definitely in our 40s, like so much wrapped up in our own lives. And I think that's basically what happened, but I think that's like the natural progression to some of these things. Margo, I think you're right. Because I was trying to remember, was she supposed to go to NYU or something? I can't, but I don't remember. Yeah.
I really don't remember.
And I'm like,
I
suppose she could make it, but I'm just like, I'm not optimistic. And in the very least, she tries to go home at one point, even though that's like her last resort. But I don't think she would. I don't think she wants to, but I think at one point maybe she does. But I don't think.
Or waits until her sister leaves home and then goes with her sister.
Like, you know, catch up with Q and Margo now. It's what, almost 15 years later. It's more than 15 years later, and I don't think they've heard from each other in years. You know, and that's a little sad, but I'm so curious to what happened to her and such.
Yeah.
Yeah. So is this required reading?
Trying to think of alternatives to this particular story. I'm going to say no. Obviously, I'm biased in it. But yeah, I feel like I'm trying to like think of other alternatives that we could. I mean, obviously, there's like Catcher in the Rye, potentially. Thinking of other road trip stories on the road, which I know you don't like.
Well, I mean, know. I could always reread it, but yeah, I didn't like it the first time.
Yeah, I just feel like there might be something better than this. I'm so sorry that I cannot off the top of my head think of something. But yeah, I mean, it would make for a fascinating discussion. Obviously, we talked about it for 2 hours. So I think it's definitely possible to bring into a high school curriculum. Mm-hmm. I just wouldn't want to do it.
I'm going to agree with you with an asterisk. Like if somebody said they wanted to read this, I would totally say, yeah, go ahead and read it. I mean, I would recommend it. You know, if they say if they were interested in reading it and asked me if it's worth reading, I'd say, yes, it's definitely worth reading. I think Green has better books. I really like Looking for Alaska, which is actually a very similar premise, except a little bit darker.
Is Alaska a person?
It's the name of a okay. girl. So it's a personal kind of novel. Turtles All the Way Down is really interesting too. I really like his writing. So if somebody were to ask me about taking this, I say yeah, but it's not one that I'm like, oh, you have to go absolutely go read this. I mean, but I really did enjoy it. So yeah, it's kind of like I'm kind of in the middle of it. Like I'd recommend it. But it's not like required.
Okay. Yeah.
So, we just have a cup.
It's not required.
Sorry. Required.
No, I was just saying in a Boston accent, it's not required.
All right. So we have I'm going to read a couple of little bits of feedback we have, regarding the upcoming Smut special as it was, at the end of episode 89 from Robert Ward, who said, I can't wait. He said, I talked a little with Stella about smut/written porn and certainly read my share of good and what WTF stories. Today, she actually finished a romance novel that I mentioned in passing as being in my reading queue. I'm dying to hear her thoughts. This next episode is going to be so fun. So I hope he enjoyed it. I'm waiting to hear what his thoughts are. And then you said, as I was editing episode 90 and I got to the part of I've read no romance books with a virginal male character, I have since discovered one, though he was not the lead of the book and has yet to have his own book. Can you elaborate on that? And then you said RE consent MMCs turning down FMCs when they're drunk. So let's dive into that for just a little bit.
So there was just we talked about how consent is really big in these novels, which we approved of the ones we read, I should say, because of course there's the whole consensual non-consent business. I stay away from those, but we were approving of that. And I did forget that there are a couple, like, I don't think it happened in the one that you read from L. Kennedy, but a couple like drunk scenes where the girl is intoxicated and really does want to get with the guy. And the guy is like, this is really hard for me, but we can't do it. And I was like, it warms my heart just because that is something that I think we do need to teach both sexes, just in terms of, yeah, being safe and what consent actually is. And, you know, even if someone's like saying yes, but they have like some sort of inebriation going on, we should probably say that that is a no, because you could be taking advantage of somebody. So I approved of that. And then, yeah, I think you had asked, because Grace was a virgin and I've encountered a couple others. And I think you had asked, like, have there been any male lead characters that were virgins? And at that time I said no, which were like, well, I guess that's, you know, we want maybe, I don't know, it's this idea that we want a guy that's more experienced. And then literally this is what happens to me is like I see something on Instagram, then it happens to me. I read something and there was a side character who very much plays it off like he's a player, but then you find out that he's actually a virgin. He like tells the lead females like, oh my gosh, oh my, he doesn't have his own book. But I just sped read the Pucker next door, and he was a virgin. So he was the lead male and he was a virgin. And he did not want to have sex with the lead female because he was a virgin. He's just like, I can't do it. And it was really interesting how she tackled it. I guess there was just like a lot of maybe shame attached to it, or he was worried that he was going to finish very quickly. So different fears attached when the female is a virgin versus a male. And I don't know if that's like the perception, because female writer, is that what, you know, a male would be most concerned with, like finishing early, and like he's just like nervous about kind of all the sensations, even though this is like a 30-year-old man. No, he was in college, so like a 20-year-old.
I mean, I'm trying to think back, and I think there's also a male ego aspect to it, masculinity aspect to it, that you feel like you're almost like you're not a real man because you haven't had the sex yet. And like you're past the age of which you should, so you're late, and you know, in the grand scheme of things, who gives a crap? But I think at that age, it's I don't know what this generation is like. I know this generation of teenagers is actually doing a lot less. There's just talk about how there's a lot of talk about how Gen Z, and I don't know about Gen Alpha, but Gen Z is not as rushing into things, and especially not also with drinking too. Not as much. And I'm sure that there are plenty of teenagers nowadays who still drink, smoke, and, you know, whatever. But at the same time, I don't know if the common tropes of your teenage entertainment of, you know, gotta have sex before we graduate are a thing. But yeah, it would be interesting. It's interesting. Yeah. That'd be an interesting character to write. A guy who's a virgin going into college and trying to navigate that. And I think it's a legitimate fear, because you, as much as you try to downplay what is very typical cliche male ego crap about your performance and what a girl will think of you, it's still there. I think it's just still in your ego, or it's programmed into you, and I think on some level you still feel it, even though you're trying to avoid that. You're trying to say it's really not that big of a deal. I think just subconsciously sometimes it's still there, and I think that would be an interesting thing to explore. And I'm with you on the consent thing and the drunken, because the drunken hookup is like a cliche in college stories, right? Yeah. I mean, you know, so it's not out of the ordinary that people have drunken hookups, but the whole, like, she was so drunk and I actually was like, no, you can't.
And if there are feelings involved. Yeah.
So I've also seen, I can't remember where I've seen a scene where it was a scene like that, where she was obliterated and coming on to him and he was turning her down and she got pissed at him.
Oh dear.
And like, but I don't remember where I saw that. It was like in a TV show or movie, and he was just kind of like, walked away or whatever. It was just kind of like, you know, you need to sleep this off or something. And she was all pissed at him for, you know, not going for it and blah, blah, blah. And he's like doing it out of respect for her. But I, like I said, I can't, it's on the tip of my tongue where I saw it, but I don't
remember. Yeah. Sounds familiar.
So, all right. Yeah. I mean, this was, I mean, that episode was so much fun to do, and I actually really enjoyed that.
Yes. I enjoyed it.
We got one more coming up before you head up to Balmer.
What?
Balmer, Maryland.
Balmer. Is that how people say it?
Weird Maryland.
Good morning, Baltimore. So, indeed.
And that is your pick for episode 92. So, Stella, what are we reading for next episode?
Yes. Well, we've mentioned this graphic novel at least probably three times, counting this particular episode. I feel it's only right. Also, it'll be close to Pride Month. I mean, we'll be recording Pride Month, so maybe we can count it that way. And every month should be Pride Month. So we're going to look at Genderqueer by Maya Kababe. I did look up the phonetic pronunciation. Okay. So that is what I believe Maya's last name is pronounced. And I will probably just repeat Maya's name so that I don't mess up the pronouns. But yeah, we can bring that up again. So I'm looking forward to it, since it is what the top number one
challenge
most
book
challenged,
in, at least as of last year. And there is the pronouns come up in the book, and her choosing those type of pronouns are part of the book. So we will have a discussion about what those are. So, because I have read it before, so it'll be interesting to read it again. Yeah. And yeah, so come back in about a month for that. Until then, just, you know, as always, send us some feedback. What did you think of this? What did you think of previous episodes? Are you still hung up on our smut? And all those things. And as always, thank you very much for listening and take care.
You might need a couple blue fins to get you through that smut episode, but I did cut it down from 3 hours to 2:45. Yeah.
It took me 2 days to finish. Good night.
Oh, no.
Well, at least I didn't finish early.
Oh!
Whoa, but chew! Thanks for listening to Required Reading with Tom and Stella, which is brought to you by Two True Freaks. That's Two True Freaks. If you're interested in learning more about the books we've read or want to comment on the episode, follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/Required Reading with Tom and Stella.
If you would like to email us to comment on the episode or continue our discussion, you can reach us at requiredreadingcast@gmail.com. We will read every email we get on future episodes.
We're looking for more visibility, so if you liked this episode or the show in general, why not leave us a review in iTunes? Thanks again for listening, and come back next month for our next episode.